KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is also available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Board meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month, starting at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
Join KBOO by December 31st and receive free gifts and prizes from the Give Guide. Just click the donate banner on the KBOO app to keep community radio strong and vibrant in Portland and beyond.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, five have been sentenced to death in the killing of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi.
A Park Rose High School coach is named one of Time Magazine's Heroes of the Year.
And later, we interview Albert Lee, a Democratic primary candidate for Oregon's 3rd Congressional District.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, December 23rd, 2019. I'm Jeffrey Wade.
And I'm Michelle Coppola. A court in Saudi Arabia has sentenced five people to death for the killing of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Three others were found guilty of covering up the crime and were sentenced to 24 years in prison between them. All those convicted can appeal their sentences, but notably, no one aside from those who directly participated faced any charges, namely Saudi authorities. Independent media was barred from the trial, and the outcome has led Amnesty International to call the verdict a whitewash, and an investigator for the United Nations to call it a, quote, mockery of justice. Khashoggi was a vocal critic of the royal family in Saudi Arabia, even as the relaxation of some social norms heaped praise onto the crown prince. He reported on the continued crackdown on dissent that has been executed by the prince. 15 Saudi agents flew to Turkey to meet with Khashoggi in the Saudi consulate, where the journalist was supposed to pick up documents that would allow him to marry. He never walked out, and his body has not been found. The individuals that met Khashoggi were intelligence and security officers who worked for the Saudi Crown Prince's office. This raised crucial questions, such as, how could this high level of operation have been carried out without the Crown Prince's knowledge? On 60 Minutes, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman said that he takes full responsibility for the killing as the leader in Saudi Arabia, but reiterated that he had no knowledge of the allegedly rogue operation.
A Park Rose High School security guard, football, and track coach has been named one of Time Magazine's 2019 Heroes of the Year. Former Oregon Duck football star Keenan Lowe was honored for his bravery and quick thinking in disarming a student with a firearm earlier this year. Lowe disarmed Angel Granados Diaz on May 17th at Park Rose High School. Granados Diaz was seen brandishing a shotgun. Lowe was able to grab the gun and secure the student. Lowe told police and high school officials, "I didn't see an evil kid, but one that was going through a lot." Granados Diaz was sentenced to 36 months of probation and mental health treatment. In addition to honors from Time Magazine, Lowe has also been awarded the Civilian Medal for Heroism and recognition from the Portland Trailblazers. The Oregon Senate also unanimously voted to adopt a resolution honoring Lowe.
After the cap and invest bill didn't pass in the 2019 session of the state legislature, Oregon environmental groups are pushing for lawmakers to try again. As KBOO's Althea Billings tells us, if a bill doesn't pass, environmental advocates say ballot measures on climate action could be coming next November.
Oregon's climate future could be decided in several ways in the new year. During the legislature's short session in February, lawmakers will take another crack at a cap and invest bill. In the 2019 session, Republican senators walked out of the Capitol to prevent passage of House Bill 2020. If the legislature doesn't take steps next year, climate advocates have ballot initiatives for the November election awaiting titles. Brad Reed with Renew Oregon says environmental groups are working with lawmakers again and want them to follow through with a cap and invest program.
that process is going fast and furious right now. There's negotiations going on to make it work in the legislature. But what we learned is that the legislative process is not a guarantee.
State Senator Michael Dembro says lawmakers are considering a proposal that would limit carbon emission in stages, starting with the Portland area. Opponents of HB 2020 said the bill's cost would have been passed on at the pump, which would have mainly hurt rural Oregonians who drive longer distances and use more fuel. The 2020 legislature begins February 3rd, and if there's no climate action, a coalition of Oregon groups will push for two ballot measures. The first would require utilities to use 100% carbon-free energy sources by 2045. The second would require the state to be free of greenhouse gas pollution by 2050. Reed says Oregon can't wait any longer, noting scientists' predictions that countries must stem carbon pollution drastically in the next decade in order to avoid the worst effects of climate change.
What we do in the next 10 years is the most meaningful. That means that a second grader in Oregon will essentially have their climate fate sealed by the time they graduate high school.
In addition to legislative action and ballot measures, Reed says groups are asking Governor Kate Brown to act. They want Brown to use her executive authority to make greenhouse gas limits mandatory and intensify the Clean Fuels Program to reduce emissions from the transportation sector faster. For KBOO Evening News and the Oregon News Service, I'm Althea Billings.
A Saturday morning stabbing at an Eastern Oregon truck stop is being investigated as a hate crime. The Ontario Police Department said Ronell Hughes, a 48-year-old black man, was stabbed multiple times in the neck by Nolan Strauss, 26, of Nebraska. The attack occurred inside of an Arby's restaurant at the Pilot truck stop just outside of Ontario, Oregon. Police say that Hughes was seeking employment at the truck stop before Strauss's unprovoked assault took place. Strauss is a truck driver and police say had no prior relationship to Hughes. He remains in Malheur County Jail on charges of attempted murder, assault, and intimidation. Police said in a statement, quote, "The motive for the attack leans heavily towards a racially motivated crime." Hughes is currently in an Idaho hospital and is reported in stable condition.
A University of Oregon student is suing the vaping company Juul and its parent company Altria, alleging that the companies were negligent in their marketing to young adults. Kumar Imani says he started using Juul in 2018 and he had never used nicotine products before. According to the complaint filed in Lane County Circuit Court on Friday, Imani was not warned of the health effects of the products nor how much nicotine it contained. Now, he says he is addicted to nicotine and suffered a seizure after using Juul. This is not the first class action lawsuit against the company. In May, a 15-year-old filed against the company after suffering seizures, and in October, a Colorado teen filed a suit claiming he had suffered severe injuries and developed a nicotine addiction. Juul is the dominant e-cigarette on the market, capturing 76% of sales in 2018. That's according to the Winston-Salem Journal. This is no coincidence. Juul has been criticized for marketing its product to young people through social media and neglecting to mention that the product contains nicotine or how much until federal regulators required it. Congress and plaintiffs in these lawsuits alike say that Juul took a page out of Big Tobacco's strategy book in the 70s and 80s, marketing to children and downplaying potential side effects.
Downtown Salem has some return visitors today, following last week's camping ban ordinance coming into effect. A group of homeless campers have returned to Capitol Mall, protesting the ban that relocated dozens more the week prior. Salem's anti-camping ban, which prohibits daytime camping on public sidewalks and property, took effect December 16th. Police asked for individuals to voluntarily move before being cited. City officials reported that campers were complying peacefully, with several moving across the street or vying for beds in shelters. Monday morning saw a return of some of those displaced in a protest statement to the grounds at Capitol Mall. Oregon State Police say they are working with Oregon State Parks and different homeless advocacy groups to identify options and avoid enforcement actions. Kathy Ersprung with the City of Salem told Coin 6, quote, "Our goal is voluntary compliance. We understand citations and arrests are not long-term solutions."
One of the first two Muslim women elected to the U.S. House of Representatives will be visiting Portland next month. Representative Rashida Tlaib, a Democrat from Michigan, is the keynote speaker at a January 24th fundraiser for the Oregon chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations. They're a nonprofit advocacy group. The banquet will be held at the Hyatt Regency in Northeast Portland, and Tlaib will address the audience in celebration of CARE Oregon's accomplishments, Muslims, and civil rights. Born to Palestinian immigrants, Tlaib was born and raised in Detroit. Known for her progressive politics, she has strongly opposed President Trump since her election to Congress. Tlaib and Representative Ilhan Omar, a Democrat from Minnesota, became the nation's first Muslim congresswomen during last November's midterm elections. Those elections saw the number of women in Congress increase by 17, with a record number of women of color taking congressional seats.
Loopholes in the new tax code abound. At least that's according to a new report, which says that money could have helped to build roads, pay down the federal deficit, and better fund social programs have instead padded corporate bottom lines after Trump's 2017 tax reforms. Suzanne Potter has the story.
Government took in $79 billion fewer corporate tax dollars than it would have before the 2017 Trump tax reforms took effect, according to a new report. Researchers with the nonprofit Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy evaluated the profits of 279 Fortune 500 companies and found that even though the law lowered the tax rate from 35% to 21%, corporations paid on average just 11.3%. Report co-author Matthew Gardner says that's because the tax bill failed to eliminate huge loopholes.
That's big news, because part of the point of cutting corporate tax rates was supposed to be that we could broaden the base, make it so that the legal tax rate is what companies actually end up paying. That doesn't seem to be happening.
Instead, the report found 91 corporations that paid no federal taxes, including California-based Chevron, plus Amazon, Halliburton, and IBM. The Trump administration insisted the change would bring millions in offshore profits back to the U.S. and spur more job creation. But the report found instead companies for the most part chose to execute large stock buybacks, which benefit shareholders, not employees. And Gardner says it's all perfectly legal. Corporations are simply taking advantage of the tax breaks that they lobbied Congress to get.
So it would take a real change of heart among elected officials to turn around and fix this problem. But, the glass half full argument is that they broke it, they can fix it.
The authors suggest that Congress repeal full expensing of capital investments and limit the ability of tech and other companies to use executive stock options to reduce their taxes by generating costs that far exceed what companies actually incur. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Massachusetts researchers have developed a way to detect dementia with a new electronic health records algorithm. The patients most at risk for symptoms of early onset dementia were three times more likely to receive a dementia diagnosis in the future. That's in comparison to patients in the overall sample. Laura Ross-Brow-Tellum has more on that story.
Massachusetts researchers can detect early dementia symptoms just by combing through existing data on healthy people. A team from Mass General and Harvard created software that automatically scans through electronic health records to predict the likelihood a person may develop dementia. They looked at more than 500,000 electronic health records of patients admitted to two Boston academic medical centers. Dr. Thomas McCoy is the first author of a paper the group just published in the journal Alzheimer's and Dementia. McCoy explains that they divided the patients into four groups, with the highest quarter being the most likely to develop a dementia diagnosis.
Individuals who were in the highest risk quartile were three times more likely to go on to receive a diagnosis of dementia than those individuals who were in the cohort overall.
This three times likelihood probably is underestimating potential diagnoses, since they can only read the files of patients who followed up at these two hospitals. Their algorithm scanned up to 8 years of records for each individual. It used natural language processing to find key terms about cognitive symptoms. It took the team about 6 years to develop the algorithm. But once their software was up and running, McCoy says it took a remarkably short amount of time to analyze the health records.
The actual process of scoring all of these notes, it ran overnight. So the computer can read through 500,000 charts in a night. You come in the next morning, you get it, you run the analysis.
McCoy notes that they merely looked at simple cognitive symptoms from patient records. With just this data, his team was able to develop a dementia score. I'm Laura Rosbrow-Tellum, reporting for Public News Service.
The Oregon Liquor Control Commission has said no to alcoholic beverages containing marijuana, a new ruling finds. Beginning January 1st, beer and other alcoholic drinks may not contain THC, the psychoactive component of cannabis, or CBD, the non-psychoactive part said to relieve pain and stress. OLCC spokesman Mark Pettinger cited concerns raised by federal agencies linking CBD usage with potential liver damage. Pettinger said Friday, quote, "There's very little scientific evidence surrounding CBD usage." He continued, quote, "People are taking it for wellness, but not a lot is known about it, its interactions with other substances, including alcohol." He went on to say that until federal agencies can establish regulations surrounding long-term cannabis usage, the OLCC felt it needed to step in and impose the ban. Next up, the agency is reviewing a ban prohibiting bars from mixing a non-alcoholic CBD beverage with alcohol to create a CBD cocktail. The OLCC has said it will be educating licensees in January following the ban's enactment and cracking down heavily in February.
The Puget Sound area is considering a bold new clean fuel standard. As Eric Tegedoff reports, the region has been a leader in tackling climate change, but there are a number of issues the public wants officials to consider before adopting that new policy.
The Puget Sound region has proposed cutting emissions from its biggest greenhouse gas source, the transportation sector. Public comment on this clean fuel standard ends January 6th. The Puget Sound Clean Air Agency rule aims to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from transportation by 26% by 2030 in King, Kitsap, Pierce, and Snohomish counties. The agency board proposing this rule is made up of elected officials, including regional mayors and council members. At a public hearing on it in Seattle last week, Rebecca Ponzio with the Washington Environmental Council says people came out in the rain to support this rule because they want clean air and more fuel options.
They appreciate this region taking that issue seriously and that this is something that can be done and should be done to make sure that we are tackling the largest source of climate pollution in our region.
Transportation accounts for more than 40% of the state's emissions. Last legislative session, lawmakers shot down a similar fuel standard for the state. The oil and petroleum industries say the cost for the new rule will be passed on to Washingtonians at the pump. Sarah Cornett with Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility says medical groups, including the Washington Medical Association and Washington Academy of Family Physicians, are getting behind this proposal for its health benefits.
The healthcare community is becoming increasingly concerned with the health impacts of climate change and calling on policymakers to take strong action, which we know can both reduce harmful air pollution while also limiting our contributions to climate change. So we see this as a win-win policy.
The technical analysis for this rule found it could result in healthcare savings of up to $45 million due to the avoidance of premature deaths from respiratory distress. Cornett says this could be a conservative estimate, since it only takes into account particulate pollution and not other toxic air pollutants from tailpipes. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
There has been lots of talk of the ballot Democrats will see in their primary states, but what about Republicans? In North Carolina, the GOP originally only put Donald Trump's name on the ballot, but primary candidates Bill Weld and Joe Walsh have petitioned the state to make sure voters also see their names when they go to the polls. With that story and more, here's Lily Bulkley with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 election process from the studios of KHOI in the heart of Iowa.
The Republican Party should be all about competition between Republican candidates during the primary, just like the Democrat Party is. And then after the primary, you know, you come together and you get behind the candidates who have won.
Former Illinois Congressman Joe Walsh, one of two GOP primary challengers to President Trump, responding to some state Republican parties that have either canceled their primaries or plan to only include the president's name on the ballot. North Carolina's GOP was one of those. It had only submitted the president's name to the State Board of Elections until Walsh and former Massachusetts Governor Bill Weld petitioned, saying they meet the requirements of a state law that says if a candidate is generally recognized in national or North Carolina media, they're on the ballot. On Friday, the board voted in their favor, and voters in North Carolina will see their names at the polls. Here's Walsh again.
You've got myself and Bill Weld. He's a former governor. I'm a former congressman. Two credible candidates.
Weld says his campaign strategy is to win over voters in crossover states, where historically voters don't always stick with the party they're registered to. But Weld says he has plenty of support within the Republican Party itself.
You know, I go into the diners and shake 200 hands at a time in New Hampshire, and I get between 2 and 10 Trump voters out of 200 people whose hands I shake there. So there's some disconnect there between the polls with a very tight screen that are focusing on the Republican State Committee and its hangers-on and those who voted in the last 5 Republican primary elections.
The Democrats, on the other hand, still have a fairly wide field. But on Friday, the DNC announced it's upping the debate requirements even further. Candidates will need steeper numbers in both polls and individual donors to get on the January stage. If billionaire environmental activist Tom Steyer can get 2 more polls above 5% and 25,000 more donors between now and January 10th, he'll be in the next debate. But the director of Monmouth University polling told the New York Times they're doing fewer polls over the holidays, and other surveyors might too.
If people run polls, you know, I will make it because that's where I am. And if people don't run polls, then I will make it in theory, but I won't make it according to the rules of the DNC.
New Jersey Senator Cory Booker recently pooled signatures from his fellow candidates in a request to the Democratic National Committee for looser qualification requirements for the next round of debates, raising questions about whether polling and donor counts are good indicators of campaign progress.
People in Iowa, people in New Hampshire, people in Nevada, people in South Carolina should determine this race, not how many billionaires, how much money is being poured in. It should be the people that are determining this race.
From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
Boeing has fired its chief executive, Dennis Muilenburg, amidst anger caused by his handling of the company's 737 MAX crisis. Boeing has been mired in turmoil since 2 737 MAX jets crashed last year, killing 346 people. Muilenburg's ousting follows ongoing friction between Boeing and regulators, lawmakers, and victims' families. The MAX 737 plane has been grounded since March. Boeing has received countless delays in its attempt to return the MAX to air. Chairman David Calhoun will officially replace Muilenburg on January 13th, with Boeing Chief Financial Officer Greg Smith serving as interim chief executive. Boeing is calling the 737 MAX crisis the worst in its 103-year history. Company stock has fallen over 20%, costing Boeing more than $8 billion and affecting a supply chain that extends to 8,000 companies. Due to unclear communications with aviation unions and lawmakers, Boeing's reputation has suffered, with many officials saying an extensive house cleaning is needed, both in personnel and in culture.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with Albert Lee, a Democratic challenger for Oregon's 3rd Congressional District. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 33. Those clouds continue into tomorrow with a high of 40 degrees. Today in history, in 1954, the first successful kidney transplant was performed by J. Hartwell Harrison and Joseph Murray between identical twins. Dr. Murray was later awarded the Nobel Prize for Medicine in 1990 for this and other work. The quote of the day is from Emma by Jane Austen, which was first published this day in 1815. Quote, "Seldom, very seldom, does complete truth belong to any human disclosure. Seldom can it happen that something is not a little disguised or a little mistaken."
The KBOO Evening News continues with a new report that shows that U.S. support for the death penalty has waned to historic lows. As Diane Bernard reports, capital punishment isn't being carried out in some states, even though they have the death penalty on the books.
Despite President Trump's efforts this summer to resurrect federal executions, support for the death penalty is at a 47-year low, according to a new year-end report. Robert Dunham is executive director of the Death Penalty Information Center, which released the report. He says it shows there were fewer than 30 executions and 50 death sentences nationwide for the fifth year in a row, marking a national decline in support for capital punishment.
The American public has moved away from capital punishment. Support for the death penalty as a whole has dropped from 80% in the 1990s to slightly above 50% today.
He says major reasons for the diminished support include a growing public preference for life imprisonment over the death penalty in murder cases and states' high legal costs associated with death sentences and executions. 21 states have now abolished the death penalty. The report says 11 death penalty states, including Indiana, have marked a decade since they've had an execution. In December 2009, Indiana put Matthew Eric Rinkles to death by lethal injection for committing multiple murders in the 1990s. Dunham says many factors have played into Indiana's declining to act on capital punishment more recently. One is because the state has made life without the possibility of parole available as a sentencing option.
Part of it is also because the American public and people in Indiana have lost their appetite for the death penalty. The death penalty isn't being imposed, it isn't being carried out, and that's something that we've seen more and more across the entire Midwest.
He adds, in the past decade, Indiana and other states, along with the federal government, have struggled to obtain the drugs needed to carry out an execution because many pharmaceutical manufacturers don't want to be associated with putting people to death. For Public News Service, I'm Diane Bernard.
A partial victory in the fight against the Keystone XL pipeline. A federal judge has left open the option of an injunction for Native tribes in the region fighting for their water rights. With that story and more, it's Antonio Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonio Gonzalez. A federal judge in Montana has handed tribes and environmentalists a pair of partial victories in their fight to stop the Keystone XL pipeline. Judge Brian Morris has denied requests for dismissal of suits against President Trump, the State Department, and other federal agencies. The actions were filed by the Rosebud Sioux Tribe, Fort Belknap Community, Indigenous Environmental Network, and a host of other opponents. Morris did not grant opponents an injunction stopping pipeline construction at this time. He said plaintiffs did not demonstrate that an injunction is necessary to preserve the status quo, but he left open the option of an injunction if it becomes necessary. TC Energy is petitioning for water rights in South Dakota and has indicated it wants to start construction in March. The state of Nebraska has approved the pipeline. Meanwhile, crime was discussed last week at South Dakota Water Management Board hearings on whether or not to allow the Keystone XL project to use local water if the pipeline is built through the state. A witness testified that reservations are vulnerable to crime and exploitation when transient workers pass through. Victoria Wicks reports.
Kate Finn is a staff attorney for First Peoples Worldwide, an organization that tracks the social and environmental effects of development on Indigenous communities. She tells board members that a sudden influx of workers living in camps can lead to an increase in crime. Four worker camps are planned to be constructed along the route of the Keystone XL pipeline through western South Dakota. Finn says nearby Indian reservations are vulnerable to the effects of crime. For one thing, the agency investigating and prosecuting could be tribal, state, or federal, depending on the race of the victim and the perpetrator and the location and type of the crime.
The result is that oftentimes reports of crime in Indian country go cold very quickly. Evidence is not picked up very quickly by the correct sovereign, or it is not passed along quickly. Investigations are usually short-lived.
Finn says sex traffickers choose recruits who have been exposed to violence, are desperate for money, and are addicted.
Many times, and especially in Indigenous communities, there's a number of vulnerabilities that all lead to a victim being engaged in commercial sex.
Finn says she gets much of her information from a U.S. Bureau of Justice statistics report on the Bakken oil fields in North Dakota. She concedes that those camps house permanent workers, whereas pipeline construction is temporary. For National Native News, I'm Victoria Wicks in Rapid City, South Dakota.
President Trump has signed into law the National Defense Authorization Act, which includes federal recognition of the Little Shell Tribe in Montana. Vaughn Golden reports from Washington, D.C.
After 150 years, the Little Shell Tribe has been formally recognized by the U.S. government. Language tucked into this year's defense appropriation measure by Montana Senators John Tester and Steve Daines will make Little Shell the 574th recognized tribe. Tester says the passage now allows Little Shell to have access to federal resources.
They're going to get the funding that as every other recognized tribe gets for education, health care, all that kind of stuff, so it really does open the door.
And one of the things the door is now open to? Formally designating the tribe's own lands. But whether those discussions have begun with Tester at this point?
Not yet. There will be. I mean, as soon as the president signs this bill, then we can have a conversation with the leadership of the Little Shell to find out what they have in mind.
The legislation to recognize the tribe was blocked for several years by Utah Senator Mike Lee. From Capitol Hill, I'm Vaughn Golden.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
In New York, workers are pressing Governor Andrew Cuomo to sign a bill that would prevent employers from hiding from wage theft claims. Andrea Sears has more.
Workers are rallying outside Governor Andrew Cuomo's office today to say they are still being ripped off by employers who steal their wages, but that he can stop it with the stroke of a pen. A bill that could aid workers who are the victims of wage theft passed both the State Assembly and Senate in June, but the governor still hasn't signed it. Carlos Rodriguez Herrera, a restaurant worker, says the Securing Wages Earned Against Theft, or SWEAT, bill would ensure that employers don't hide their assets as soon as a wage theft claim is filed.
They declare bankruptcy, shut out the restaurant, change the name, transfer the access. That's very easy to do right now because we don't have any law to prevent that.
Responding to a protest last month, a spokesperson for the governor said the SWEAT bill was still under review. The governor has until December 31st to sign it into law. The National Mobilization Against Sweatshops says an estimated $1 billion is stolen from New York workers every year. Herrera adds that the workers will keep their rallies going through the rest of the year.
If he don't sign, we're going to tell everybody how he's bad. He's not really supporting the workers, he's supporting the criminal bosses.
The workers plan to be back outside the governor's office tomorrow and every weekday after Christmas through the end of the month unless the bill is signed. For Public News Service, I'm Andrea Sears.
Psychedelic research pioneer, New Age guru, and best-selling author Baba Ram Dass has died. He was 88. Born Richard Alpert, the future spiritualist met psychologist Timothy Leary while the two taught at Harvard. The two pioneered psychedelic research through explorations with LSD and psilocybin for ever-changing generations of Americans throughout the 60s and 70s. Alpert's soul-searching led him away from LSD and found him traveling to India and studying spiritualism. Renamed Ram Dass, or Servant of God, by his guru, he started a new life in 1974 based on meditation and his own synthesis of Buddhist, Hindu, Advaita, and Sufi teachings. Ram Dass' first book for the masses, Be Here Now, offered seekers a spiritual, if not somewhat zany, path to enlightenment. The book has sold more than 2 million copies worldwide, extolling the virtues of mindfulness and grace. He devoted the rest of his life to teaching, lecturing, and tirelessly writing about techniques and principles to his adopted philosophies, which he often described as being fully present in the moment. He suffered a paralyzing stroke in 1997, but the immediate cause of death was not disclosed. Ram Dass died at his home in Maui.
The island residents of Dominica are facing major risks as a frontline community in the face of climate change. One resident is using her legal skills to advocate for climate migrants and create a framework for how they can move forward. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Ama Francis is from Dominica, a small island nation in the Caribbean.
It's one of the most beautiful places on Earth. It's filled with mountains and rivers and hot springs and beaches.
It's also on the front lines of climate change. 90% of Dominica's population lives in coastal villages. They're vulnerable to flooding as seas rise and tropical storms grow more intense. In 2017, Hurricane Maria ravaged the island and forced about a fifth of residents to flee, some permanently. Frances was in law school, and the crisis drove home the importance of what she was learning.
International law doesn't provide any protection to climate migrants. There's no convention that covers climate migration in the way that people who are moving as refugees, for example, have. And I thought this was a huge gap. It felt really important to me to be working on creating legal support for climate migrants.
Now, Frances is doing so as a fellow at the Sabin Center for Climate Change Law at Columbia University. She researches and advocates for international agreements to help climate migrants, like those from Dominica, resettle and work in new countries. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
The European Union is planning a man-on-the-moon moment around the climate crisis. With that story and more, here's Week in Water.
Jack Frost nipping at your nose? There may be a cure. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
Europe is planning to take bold steps to shift away from fossil fuels and reduce greenhouse gas emissions in the next 10 years, with the goal of reaching net zero emissions by 2050.
In what it's calling the Green Deal, the European Union outlined 10 goals, described as the continent's man-on-the-moon moment, to reconcile its economy with the planet.
Euractiv reports that one key component of the deal is to develop a circular economy that uses fewer materials in products and to make sure they can be reused and recycled.
Another goal is to reduce air, soil, and water pollution by 2050, in particular from the agricultural sector, by using significantly less pesticides, fertilizers, and antibiotics.
An additional objective is to double or even triple the renovation rate of buildings to make them more efficient. Household boilers and heaters are responsible for 40% of the EU's total energy consumption, making them one of the biggest contributors to global warming emissions in Europe.
In the transportation sector, the EU will promote sustainable fuels for aviation, road transportation, and shipping.
The Green Deal was met with some skepticism. A spokesperson for Greenpeace said the climate targets were too little, too late.
An effective and natural way to remove carbon from the atmosphere is through trees, and some have superpowers.
Three tropical trees in particular have remarkable abilities to make it rain, nurture surrounding ecosystems, or store carbon. But as Vox reports, they're all threatened by deforestation, and if they disappear, the effects could be irreversible.
The Brazil nut tree, an icon of the Amazon rainforest, channels an extraordinary amount of water from the soil to the sky, which makes the rainforest rain. One nut tree can pump more than 260 gallons per day up its trunk and through its leaves into the air to make precipitation happen in distant places.
Another tree found along Indonesian coasts is the stilt mangrove. Besides protecting communities from typhoons and tsunamis, the tree is unusually good at removing and storing carbon for thousands of years.
A third tree is the African teak tree, which grows in the Congo Basin. It has the ability to support other species in addition to the surrounding ecosystem by supplying food and shade for animals. It's also resistant to fire.
These three super powerful trees are threatened by farming, mining, ranching, and logging. Their loss would have devastating consequences such as increased warming, extreme weather, and the collapse of biodiversity.
During recent years, microplastics have been detected nearly everywhere on the planet, in Arctic ice, the Great Lakes, the Rocky Mountains, and even in the digestive tracts of sea animals. New research shows that there could be a million times more microplastics in the oceans than previously thought.
Much of the microplastics break off clothes put through washing machines, but a new device might make it possible to get the plastics out of laundry water.
Researchers at Shinchu University in Japan developed a method of using acoustic waves to herd tiny plastics into a channel so they can be captured and disposed of properly.
The device isn't quite ready for use in washing machines because currently the process takes too long.
Nitrates from fertilizers flow down the Mississippi River, creating dead zones in the Gulf of Mexico, and they also seep into groundwater, contaminating supplies of cities and towns.
Paul Black at the University of Nebraska thinks he has a way to remove nitrates by growing algae.
As NET News reports, the algae are bred in a series of water-filled tubes. The microorganisms feed on the nitrates and, as a bonus, produce oil that can be used as a fuel and create biomass that can be ground up for fertilizer.
Another benefit to the technology is that it costs only 5 to 10% of the conventional method of removing nitrate through reverse osmosis.
Next spring, Black will start treating thousands of liters of water in partnership with a city in Nebraska, saying the state is at the epicenter of the nitrate pollution problem in the Midwest. And finally, 'tis the season for cheerful songs about Jack Frost nipping at your nose and folks dressed up like Eskimos. But winter can be a risky time for injury from extreme cold, such as frostbite.
Frostbite happens when skin freezes after being exposed to extreme cold. Blood vessels in the fingers, toes, or cheeks constrict to reduce blood flow and channel heat towards vital organs.
If the areas go too long without warmth, the tissue may start to die from lack of oxygen, leading to gangrene or infection and potentially amputation if not addressed in time.
Conventional treatments include soaking the affected body part in warm water and applying anti-inflammatory creams, but these solutions may not be available in isolated areas, and topical medications could freeze.
With this in mind, a team of researchers from India have developed a gel that could offer immediate treatment of frostbite.
The so-called nano spray gel contains the blood thinner heparin that increases blood flow to injured areas, along with ibuprofen to reduce pain and inflammation. The spray contains propylene glycol to keep it from freezing.
When the gel was sprayed on frostbite injuries in rats, the wounds healed completely within 14 days, compared to those with no treatment.
And while conventional creams healed frostbite by 80% within 2 weeks, the gel healed injuries 100% in the same time frame.
Further studies will be needed to test its usefulness on people who work or play outside to determine its full potential.
You can keep this newscast from freezing up by going to h2oradio.org, where your gift will be doubled now until December 31st.
This Week in Water is sponsored by the American Water Works Association, the world's largest organization of water supply professionals.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, December 23rd, 2019. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes the ever-articulate Jeffrey Wade, the producer is the intrepid Althea Billings, and our engineer is the exemplary Danielle Parks. The director of Evening News is also Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Michelle Coppola.
And I'm Jeffrey Wade. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show, covering politics, history, and the state of the zeitgeist with a liberal dose of listener comments. At 9, Alternative Radio features lectures and interviews with progressive thinkers. At 10, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11, it's Stage and Studio, discussing The Mystery of Opal Whiteley, a half-hour documentary on a young woman from Cottage Grove who became the center of an international controversy. At 11:30, hear Art Focus, featuring interviews with artists, curators, and critics. KBOO is an independent, non-commercial, community radio station powered by our volunteers and our members. By making a donation through Gift Guide on kboo.fm/give, you're eligible for more than $4,000 of free and discounted products from your favorite Portland brands. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
For 23 years, Oregon's 3rd Congressional District has been represented by the same man in a bow tie. This election cycle, however, Albert Lee is challenging Representative Earl Blumenauer for the 2020 Democratic primary for Oregon's 3rd District. Oregon's 3rd Congressional District covers most of Multnomah County, including Gresham, Troutdale, and the greater part of Portland. It also encompasses the northeastern part of Clackamas County. Lee is a veteran of the United States Army and most recently was academic dean at Portland Community College. He's also endorsed by the Portland Democratic Socialists of America, and if elected, he would be Oregon's first biracial congressman. Welcome to the show, Albert.
Thank you. Thank you, Michelle.
Yeah, great to be having you on the show tonight. What inspired you at this time to run for office? Why now?
Yeah, sure. So first of all, I believe that democracy requires choice. It's something that we haven't had here in over a generation. We face a series of crises here in this district, across the country, and around the world that require bold action now, and not just inspirational and aspirational words. Now, also, I believe in the basic tenets of the Democratic Party when it comes to diversity, equity, and inclusion. I think it's time that we uplift some new voices from some other backgrounds, from some other lived experiences to represent us here in the most diverse district of our state. And then finally, I think it's time that we end this oligarchy of career elite multimillionaire politicians ruling over us, and replacing them with citizen representatives who know the struggle, who won't take corporate contributions, and who will truly represent and fight for the people.
We were talking earlier, and you mentioned that you had filed in April, and since then you've been highlighting issues that the 3rd District is facing. You touched on that just a moment ago and about how you're familiar with them. Let's talk about homelessness first in the region. What could leadership be doing differently on that issue? What actions would you like to see taken?
Some action, first of all.
Right.
You know, first of all, I got to tell you that I've experienced homelessness myself. In high school, my family faced domestic violence, which in turn led to our homelessness, and we were homeless in battered women's shelters in a couple different states. I ended up graduating after attending 5 different high schools in 3 different states. I know the experience of homelessness from one perspective, and I know that there are many different perspectives that are out there. But when we're talking about homelessness, what the federal government can do is to provide the funds and give it to the local and the county areas to do programs like Housing First. Housing First programs that they have in areas like Salt Lake City, New Orleans, and examples in Scandinavia that work very well.
Well, I mean, the solution for houselessness is a home.
You got it.
Right?
Yeah.
That first things first.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Exactly. Another issue that a lot of people are concerned about, it's a major political topic this year, the climate emergency. What should we and could we be doing on a local level that's not being done presently?
Yes. So, you know, we've got to do everything we can to curtail the use of fossil fuels. That's number one. We can do so many different things, like investing in our public transit system. I mean, Kansas City just came out with free public transportation for all. And that's one of the things that we talk about on our website, is that we need to incentivize people to get out of their single-use vehicles and to get onto public buses, public trains. That's one thing. We need to also take a look at our entire economic system that's based on a fossil fuel economy and convert it into something that is based on a renewable fuel economy.
So let me ask you, I want to delve into that just a little bit. When you talk about free public transit for all, how do we pay for that? How is that funded? Because, I mean, you know, at this point, you're looking at if you make all the train rides free, all the bus rides free.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you fund that?
So, you know, it's funny that people always ask, how do you pay for services when it comes to helping regular everyday Americans? But when it comes to helping the ultra rich get another tax break, or when it comes to spending ungodly sums of money for military expenditure, foreign policy, we don't discuss those issues. But I'll tell you what, I sat on TriMet's Transit Equity Advisory Committee for over a year, and that was one of the questions that I asked TriMet was, well, how much money do we spend, or how much money is generated from fares? The answer was something around 17%. But then you factor in things like, well, how much do we pay for in fare enforcement? How much do we pay for in administrative costs? All of a sudden, that cost goes down into the single digits. Our collection of revenue goes down to single digits. So it is very easy to get rid of fares and make a public transit policy that is going to help to encourage people to get out of the vehicles. And, you know, that will also help us not do things like, I don't know, expand the Rose Quarter expressway for the amount of money that
I-5
it would cost.
Through the Rose Quarter.
Yeah. And that in turn talks, you're talking about trying to help eliminate the air quality and environmental concerns. So it all wraps together.
Ding, ding, ding. Good answer.
Thank you.
You know, you have expressed support for the Green New Deal from Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. What inspires you about her program, and how would you like to see it executed?
Well, you know, first of all, I got to tell you that when we talk about environmental pollution, it affects black and brown folks more than any others. I remember growing up in St. Louis. My great-grandfather had a house in Kinloch, which was the first black suburb that folks were allowed to live in outside of the city back in the early 1900s. Now, this suburb, this Kinloch, was located right next to Lambert International Airport. Now, as Lambert wanted to expand, it was surrounded by a whole bunch of different suburbs. It decided to go through Kinloch because that was the poorest and blackest area. When I was growing up there, we had the noise pollution, we had the fossil fuel pollution, all of these things. So one of the greatest things that I like about AOC's plan is the just transition portion of it, to ensure that we take a look at two things. Number one, we take a look at the folks that are working in the fossil fuel industries and making sure that they are transitioned out of that and they're taken care of. And number two, to ensure that we're looking at the disparate impacts on black and brown folks and marginalized folks.
Right. Those neighborhoods don't get to scream NIMBY, right?
Yes.
Yeah, that's right. So you're a member of the Democratic Socialists of America, same as Bernie, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. What does capitalism, as far as the role of capitalism, how does it play into the issues that we've been discussing?
Well, you know, capitalism is sort of kind of like the root of all evils, right? It is a system that is doing exactly what it's supposed to do, and that is to take and extract wealth and push it up to the very top. So again, some of the reasons why we haven't addressed the issues when it comes to the climate is because we've got a lot of fossil fuel companies and corporations and the wealthy that are paying our corporate politicians a lot of money to look the other way. Right. You know, both sides of the aisle.
They're heavily invested in things continuing as they are and in unrestrained growth.
Absolutely.
Without the human cost being considered and being factored in. So you advocate for something called economic justice. For people who may not have heard about that idea before, can you explain what that means and how it could be enacted on a personal scale?
Yeah, I mean, so when you're looking at economic justice, right now we arguably have a political democracy, right? You mate that political democracy with economic democracy. So I'll give you an example. The CEO of McDonald's makes more in an hour than the average worker at McDonald's makes in a year. Now, things like that, those obscene amounts of money, that kind of situation would not happen if you actually had workers participating in those boardroom meetings, if they had a say. I don't think you have those obscene amounts of money going to the very top. You would have more regulation. You would have more equality, more fairness if everyone got a say in how to tackle things. Economic justice really means taking a look and making sure that everybody's taken care of and not just focusing on, the automatic focus of formulas of capitalism.
So you sort of answered this next question when you initially started speaking with us, but I want to know, what makes your candidacy different from previous leadership? I mean, Earl Blumenauer is known for his support and, his pursuance of democratic and liberal ideas. So how are you different?
Sure. For a lot of things, we're not going to be voting differently. We're very much aligned when it comes to the votes. Some of the things on the social levels, he had to come kicking and screaming. He voted for the Defense of Marriage Act for one thing. He voted for FOSTA SESTA for another. But generally speaking, he's been a good progressive vote. But we're in one of the most progressive districts of the country. You should be leading from these kind of districts. You should be having Democrats or leftists that are going to push the envelope to make sure that there is a strong distinction between this party and the other side. I think, quite frankly, the reason why Democrats lose across the country is because it's hard to distinguish from the other side. We need to take areas like here, New York 14 is a good example. I mean, when AOC got in, she pushed the envelope, and now she's dictating and helping to shape the message and the direction of the party.
Well, I mean, we need to energize our base and our younger people who are really, excited by the new ideas and a new direction mm-hmm. from what's been before. And I think that's probably something that is at the base of your candidacy as well here. So in your campaign materials, you mentioned a little earlier that you personally have experienced homelessness. What other lived experiences do you have that really inform your candidacy? Can you tell me what sets you apart?
Yes. I mean, I'm a sixth-generation American on the one hand. But I'm also an immigrant. I was born in South Korea, where my African-American Army dad met my Korean mom during the Vietnam War. That in and of itself is something. It is a combination of the foreign policy of the United States that helped to create me in more ways than one. And you juxtapose that. For my dad, in the late 60s, early 70s, he had a choice. His choice was either to wait for that draft card or to go ahead and sign up for the military, because there were no other opportunities for a black man out of St. Louis, North County St. Louis. Mm-hmm. So he chose to sign up. Luckily for me, they sent him to mechanic school and then eventually sent him to Korea, where he met my mom. Otherwise, he would have gone to Vietnam, and who knows if he would have made it out. In contrast, Earl had the opportunity to go to college at that same very time, and not have to deal with, having to worry about war. My mom and Earl were actually born a year apart from each other. She was born on the other side of the globe in mm-hmm. Korea, mm-hmm. A couple years before the Korean War, a couple years after World War II. Her childhood, her being a toddler, was in the middle of a war. It has provided me some experience, some understanding of things that are, that a lot of people around the world, and quite frankly, immigrant populations, understand and know. Growing up in working class St. Louis, is a heavily segregated place. My mom worked a couple of different jobs in order to put my sister and me through Catholic school, because our public school system was truly separate and unequal. And quite frankly, today, to this very day, our public school system is in serious trouble, and it's continuing to be attacked by things like charter school programs, some special religious schools, anything to extract the funds to our public education system so that we can continue segregation. These are things that I know intimately. I know these firsthand, and quite frankly, we are in the most diverse district of this state. I think
in a state that's not diverse really at all.
Correct. Right? But we are in the most diverse district of the state, and I think that it's time that we uplift some new voices from some other backgrounds, from some other lived experiences, to represent us here. If we have all our entire federal delegation, 2 senators, 5 representatives, 100% multimillionaires, 100% part of the 1%, 100% over the age of 62, 100% white, 100% property owners, that is not representative of the state. And when you're talking about citizen representation, when you're talking about democracy, it's about having people who are able to represent the entirety of their constituency and not just a small sliver of it.
So if someone wants to get involved in your campaign and learn more about it and help you out, what can they do?
Well, so first of all, we are different because we don't take corporate contributions, period. I think that it is important that you have representatives who are going to represent the people and not, these legalized people, these corporations. So you can find out more information at albertlee2020.com. I invite people to contribute there as well. You can volunteer there as well. We are out canvassing on a regular basis. We're making phone calls, phone banking. Quite frankly, we need folks to talk to their friends and neighbors to let them know that, hey, this cycle, you're actually going to have a choice. You're actually going to have a competent choice. You're going to have the ability to have a leader, to have a representative who's going to know the struggle, who's going to truly represent the people.
That's albertlee2020.com. We have been speaking with Albert Lee. He's a candidate in the Democratic primary for Oregon's 3rd Congressional District. If you'd like more information on Albert and his campaign, as we just said, it can be found at albertlee2020.com. We really appreciate you taking the time to be here. Your family's headed out on a red eye for
yeah.
Christmas, and you get to stay here with the dog and
yes,
campaign,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes, yes.
All right. Well, we wish you a Merry Christmas. And for KBOO News In Depth, I'm Michelle Coppola.
Thanks, Michelle.
And you're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Up next, Labor Radio.
This is Alyssa Pariah, your friendly neighborhood agitator, the host of The Struggle, every Friday from 7 to 8 p.m. listen to KBOO Community Radio, 90.7 FM, and online at kboo.fm. The struggle is where organizers and activists doing good in the community come to discuss their work to get you to support them, maybe even join them. Remember the struggle. Every Friday, 7 to 8 p.m., KBOO Community Radio.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio. To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening, and welcome to Labor Radio. Of the working class, for the working class, by the working class. I'm your host, Jamie Partridge. And we are joined live in the studio tonight by Aikisha Owens, president of the Workers Union at the Oregon Public Broadcasting, SEIU 503, sublocal 570. Good evening, Aikisha.
Hello, good evening, everyone.
And also here is Belinda Regan, president of the Portland Federation of School Professionals, AFT, that's American Federation of Teachers, Local 111. Thank you for joining us, Belinda.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
All right. So beginning with you, Aikisha, unionized workers make up many of the divisions of OPB, Oregon Public Broadcasting, including mail clerks, videographers, and tech support. OPB used to be owned by the and operated by the state. It's no longer part of the state government since 1993. And departments that were unionized with the SEIU remain so when the station became a privatized nonprofit. And currently you're in negotiations for a new contract, which expires at the end of this month on the 31st. And so we met you, Aikisha, on the picket line in early December. So tell our listeners what's happening with negotiations and what about the management's unilateral moves to weaken the union?
Well, yes. Well, thank you for your support for meeting me out there on the picket line. We did have that in early December, and that was to get some proposals that have since been withdrawn, but those proposals pretty much